Now more than ever. Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price. You want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's. We help. You save. Price match applies to same item. Current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at Lowe's.com/lowest price guarantee.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. You're listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 16, Episode 19. This is the second Richard Allen interrogation. We're doing analysis on that, but we are joined by a very special guest. Once again, we're joined by Dr. Scott from the wonderful LA Not So Confidential podcast, but we are sans Zach. So we still have a power trio. Zach, we miss you. There's a lot to discuss, and we certainly have input from our listeners that we want to get into as well. But before we do all that, Bob, do we have any housekeeping?
Nothing real pressing right now. We're still, as I mentioned last week, the kids podcast Underestimated is dropping 2 episodes a week right now. So Wednesday will be episode 2 of the Voiceless podcast, which is the one covering several missing persons cases. Their first one dropped last Friday. Their third one will drop this coming Friday, the same day as this. And then next week, we move on to the Janice Sanders and Janice Lang's case. That's coming up next week. So things are going well. And Janet, I guess I might as well tell you here on the air. I just want you to know the text you sent me about the one student.
Yeah.
I shared that with her and she came in over the moon yesterday. Ooh. She's a fan. She's a huge fan of yours.
Oh, my goodness. Over the moon.
She said she's going to print that out and frame it.
Oh, my gosh.
So just thought I'd let you know.
Maybe I should send her a little video text to give to her. Yeah. I mean, I just thought this last, everybody's doing such great work. Obviously, it's a matter of taste and this is no dig on any of the other students at all. I just, when I hear a young reporter talking about being emotionally affected by the story that she's reporting on, that just is a real kindred spirit for me. And I just thought it was a really dynamic episode, fascinating story. And again, just very, very proud of all the hard work that your students are putting in on Underestimated.
Well, it was very much appreciated. And they're all doing fantastic work. And now we'll get right into this one. I just had something on the top of my head and it popped right back out of there. Mm-hmm. So we'll see if that's... Oh, housekeeping still. We're going to make some changes probably for the next few... I've got 6 weeks of school left. And so at least for that time, we're going to be probably moving these follow-up recordings to Wednesday nights as opposed to Tuesday nights. So that only affects you if you're one of the people that like to join the live either through Patreon for the pregame or for the main. So next week, the plan is the same time on Wednesday nights, which is 8 p.m. Eastern time, 5 p.m. Pacific time. Janet looks confused.
I thought you said you were going to be in Montana next week.
No, that's not till June.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, great.
Yeah, June.
Got it.
First full week of June, I'll be gone. So yeah, for the foreseeable future, we'll be doing on Wednesday nights, which may come up, Dr. Scott, because I was just telling Shiloh in the chat before we got going today that I was hoping not to keep bothering you guys, but man, I'm going through the Richard Allen confessions and everything with Dr. Walla and the phone calls, and sure could use one of you guys back again next week if you or Dr. Shiloh are interested or available on Wednesday evening.
They're not going to have any time to do their other stuff.
Yeah, you just are permanent fixtures on the Truth and Justice. So we'll figure that out. Offline, but I'm breaking it all down now, and what you guys are going to get on Sunday, also released with all these other audios, was the same Crime Circus, the same YouTube channel, put out a video that has all of the phone recordings, the phone recording confessions with Richard Allen and his wife and with his mother. So that's about a 47 minute video. So I'm kind of going through those, but then I also went and did some research on Dr. Wallace's testimony, because it what seemed like was the big confession, the one that I feel probably played a large part in getting Richard Allen convicted, was Dr. Wallace's testimony about what she said Richard Allen said to her And so I'm kind of like intermingling those time, you know, so we have a phone call from April 3rd, and then we have Dr. Walla's notes from the month of the rest of the month of April. And then we have her notes from April 2nd or May 2nd, and then the phone call from May 10th. So I'm kind of putting all those in order and kind of breaking down like how this whole process came to be and give him kind of my analysis on it. So that's what's going to be coming on Sunday that I'm working on right now.
So, and just as a heads up, I have nothing scheduled for next Wednesday because my clients are out of town. That is, I like Shiloh would have to probably pull me back, like, or chain me down, because the job that
yeah,
psychologist used is the thing. It makes my blood boil.
Your episode about that was so good. I really strongly recommend people go to that. Is it ethics in psychology? Yeah. Such a great episode. They cover, Scott and Shiloh cover more than just that particular thing that happened. But I really, really appreciated your perspective and your candor about the professionalism or lack thereof of some of the behavior there.
Yeah.
Well, good. You're on, Dr. Scott. Sorry, Shiloh, for next week, because yeah, I'm getting into some of that, and where that's on the LA Not So Confidential podcast, the episode that Jan is talking about, if you want a little precursor to that. So Sunday will be me breaking those down. And then on next Wednesday, which will be the follow-up that'll air on Friday, we have Dr. Scott again to talk about that. And now we should get into this one. Before we get to Dr. Scott, Janet, what were your thoughts on this week's episode?
Well, as you know, because I sent you a text, I listened to, I watched the interview, the interrogation, before I listened to your episode, and it was a really hard listen. It was a hard watch. It was a hard listen. I was extremely, extremely upset by all of the stuff, especially with Kathy. That was just very hard. Mm-hmm. You know, no matter where you fall on this, it was just absolutely shattering to see her and hear her and get some small sense of the pain that she has been through and continues to suffer. So that made it, you know, about six times as hard if compared to the first interrogation for me personally. Then we'll get to Dr. Scott, because nobody needs to hear my pedantic non-explanations. But I guess what I would say is I thought that he seemed very not guilty in his behavior. It felt very real. Of course, I was, you know, once I listened to your episode and you were talking about something that you had gone through similar, it reminded me of one of those movies. And I'm sorry that we always compare things to media, because many of us don't experience them in real life, but we see some version of it depicted in media, which Shiloh and Scott used to actually, it was a wonderful tool on their podcast. But I felt like it was like I was watching one of those movies that I can't watch, because it's the one where one person is sane and everyone else is telling them that they're wrong or they're crazy.
Yeah.
Those are really hard for me to take. So it definitely triggered me, and I haven't even had an experience like the one you've had. Does any of that or all of that mean that Richard Allen is not guilty? Is he definitively innocent? I don't know. I wish that I could maybe, if someone wants to point me in the direction, what I would like is for a comparison, and every person is different, but I would like to sort of see a version of the Reed technique in an interrogation used where a person we know is guilty maintains their innocence. Because mm-hmm. I don't have anything to compare it to. Versus, I know what it sounds like when someone uses the Reed technique and someone falsely confesses. We've heard that many times because of the work that we're trying to do. But I don't have a lot of experience seeing people who are provably guilty, like, you know, the serial killers of the world that have been caught, maintaining their innocence. Perhaps everyone is that, you know, believable would be to me. You know, I don't know. So I guess that's what I'm saying, is like, I don't have a control of like, what does it look like when we know someone's guilty and they maintain their innocence? Does it come off as believable as Richard Allen did?
Yeah, I'd have to see. I mean, that might be a good question for like Jim Clemente. He may have like some resources that he can send us, some examples of those. Because yeah, I haven't seen that either. But it was like, you know, I know, you know, from what I've learned on statement analysis, like what you expect from the guilty person in those moments, and kind of what you expect from it. And it was just shocking to me. But then again, too, like as I tried to express, and it was just to be transparent. Because I mean, I was having a moment when I was watching it during that part. And I'm like, I feel like I need to at least share with everybody that, you know, I'm coming from a place that I have a personal bias in this, because at this point, like I'm seeing so much. Like it was one of those, And Dr. Scott, I'm sure you can, you know, from with your expertise, know what that feeling is. But it was just like when I was watching him react and go through that, it was like taking me back to that place. Like I was feeling what he was feeling. And it was like I had to step away for a minute. And then I came back and kind of wrote that part of the script. It was like, I'm just going to share this because that was something that I think is significant enough that may have influenced my own interpretation that I should share it. But Dr. Scott, what did you think?
Well, I'm just going to piggyback on both of you. I think you both make really excellent points. And I even had to consult with Dr. Shiloh this afternoon because it's, you know, we cover so many cases and I don't really dive deep into that because we're diving more into research, you know, so I, for 1 second, considered like looking on one of the Reddit pages. And then I glanced at it. I was like, oh no, not going to go here. And I say that as somebody who really admires some of the work that people post on some of these things. They post some very thoughtful things. And then there are other ones that just muddy the water so badly. And my thoughts here are, I mean, for you, Bob, yeah, you're getting re-traumatized and we all have to be careful about those things. I'll tell you where I did do a deep dive because I was only superficially familiar with read technique. So I started reading more and more. I was like, well, let me look at the stats. And the stats do not look good. The stats do not look good for this technique because it is coercive. Police are in. And again, I'm going to mirror what Janet said. I don't know if he's innocent or not. The evidence looks very, very sketchy to me. And, you know, it was so theatrical. You know, I had so many reactions to this cop sort of, this is his lens. The cop goes in with the ability to lie. He has a permit to lie, right? Like he's legally able to lie. He's throwing everything against this guy. And all I see in response, and this could mean so many different things. And I want to be careful here for everybody that's listening. Like, I don't want this to come across as like super judgmental. But he's a strange guy. Like he's odd. There are a lot of very odd things about him. But I would go so far as to say if what I'm seeing so far is not particularly creepy, like he's assured of himself, he's almost a little bit cocky. But, you know, I've seen people who absolutely knew that they were innocent. And by hook or by crook, however they were raised, they don't back down at all. And they're absolutely relaxed. Now, on the other side of that, there's a lot of really famous psychopaths that have done that. You know, Ted Bundy to the last minute, Christopher Watts, Scott Peterson, all of them just deny, deny, deny. But all of them had incredible evidence against him. And this doesn't seem like a case where there's more bluster in this interview than there is evidence, right?
Well, and that's the thing is, what we know, so what he doesn't know, and that's part of the perspective when I'm doing this, the statement analysis, right? What Richard Allen doesn't know is that Holman's full of shit about that bullet, right? I mean, there is now. I know.
But does Holman know he's full of shit about it?
Great question.
Yeah, he knows.
Okay.
He absolutely fucking knows. And I know somebody's going to be, I can probably name the names of the people that are like, yeah, what do you mean? So, you know, what it was is, you know, I talked about it in the episode, you know, they found an unspent round. They took his gun. They did six, you know, ejecting the shell without, which is, you know, recreating what actually happened to the round they found. They compared them, no match. So then they fired, I think they fired four more rounds. And of those four rounds, they found one after they fired it, which is not what happened to the one in the crime scene. And it had sufficient agreement. And we heard from, which I know there's a question about it, so I'll wait. I'm assuming, hopefully you grabbed that question. If not, I'll talk about it later.
I did.
About the testimony at trial by the firearms expert. But at trial, she said, like, no, this could have come, like, she admitted this could have come from any gun of that make and model. And they compared it to other ones. Like, there was no, where he's saying, it's forensically proven, scientifically proven, that's your gun. And I think that, to me, when I see, I was almost, the second time through, was looking at Holman's behavior. I'm like, is this an act or is he genuinely getting mad because he set this trap and it didn't fucking work? Because he's like, you know, he tells him this.
It can be both.
Yeah. He tells him, like, here it is. Now I got you. I got you. You put it on the record. I got you to say you didn't loan it out. I got you to say that you had it. We know that you had it before then. And then, boom, drop the hammer. We know with 100% certainty that bullet found 6 inches from one of the victims came from your gun. And he's like, now I got him. And generally, again, what you're hoping for by the book is you want them to start making excuses for, oh, you know what? I was out there a couple of weeks ago, so right. maybe it came.
To
you
catch
want
them something in those contradictions, right?
Yeah, they're wanting something like that, and instead, so I guess circling back to what we were just talking about is when you said that like there was this mountain of evidence against these other people. In his case, he doesn't know that Holman's full of shit. He believes he's telling him. And that was that's what I was reading from his reaction. It was just like astonishment. It was just like, what? That's impossible. He couldn't give them any other explanation other than that is impossible over and over and over and over again. As opposed to someone like, you know, like you mentioned Scott Peterson. I don't know about that case. I know there's controversy about it, whether he's innocent or guilty. I don't know anything about it. I know a little bit about it, but I'm not enough to have a strong opinion. But in that case, there's like all this evidence. And that's a different kind of thing to me when you're like, here's all the evidence that is legitimate. Whether he's innocent or guilty doesn't matter. This is legitimate evidence. He knows the evidence is legitimate and is still denying. I think that's a different thing than someone getting presented with one single piece of evidence that they're told is concrete and you can't argue it whatsoever and just saying that's bullshit. Can't be. Impossible.
That's pretty assured for him to say, for Alan to take that perspective, you know, that he says over and over again. I mean, you know, there are a lot of experiments in the early sort of the silver age of psychology about coercion, you know, with a course, a bunch of male white college students, which were the easiest group to find and do these experiments on. And the one that just showed over and over again the power of coercion was to have a group of people and in a class and being told, you know, given a simple equation or even shown a set of lines. And if all 7 out of 8 people agree that line A is longer than line B, even though it's not the person you're looking at it, and you can see, you could measure it with your finger, they will eventually collapse and agree with the group just to go to not be an outlier, to not be the center of attention. So, you know, that speaks to the power of techniques like this, and that's not necessarily a good thing. You know,
and
so it sounds
also,
like
ladies and gentlemen of the jury. Yeah.
I was just going to say exactly like, that. Same
you
thing
hear
when
that,
you
and
have.
You're like, oh, that's how juries act.
Yeah. Yep. It's exactly how they act when you have. I've been on those juries where there's, you know, you've got 2 people that are holdouts that have heard all the evidence, they've heard all the discussion, and they're like, nope, not guilty, not guilty, not guilty. And then after the second Allen charge, they come through, okay, now they're guilty. Well, what changed? Nothing changed. Nothing changed except for exactly what you're talking about. They're just tired of pushing against the herd.
And
yeah, the stats, I'm wondering, oh, sorry, Scott.
No, I mean, it was just an observation. Like I, like many people, and I know a lot of people, there are just as many probably that wouldn't disagree. I would rather have someone guilty go free than someone innocent go to prison.
Which actually,
yeah, you know,
which dovetails perfectly with what I was going to say, which is I wonder the statistics of people holding out because they insist someone's guilty versus people holding out because they insist someone is not guilty. Is it more often that the pressure that you fold if you are voting not guilty than if you are voting guilty? You know what I'm saying? Like, is it more often that someone says, I really feel this person is not guilty, but the pressure of all of these people saying this person's guilty and has to be held accountable causes me to say, okay, I'm going to say guilty, versus someone who's like, I know in my bones this person is guilty. I'm never going to say they're not guilty because they have to be accountable. You know what I'm saying? I just wonder if that's, I bet
it
it's not,
interesting,
I bet they're not equal.
I don't know if that's quantifiable, but that's a great perspective. And I wish we had the data on that. That'd be fascinating.
Yeah.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
There were a few things, I don't know, hopefully, because I'm trying to remember what they were, but I know there was a few different things, Scott, that I called you out in the episode that I wanted you to take note of. One of them that I remember.
Oh, no, I heard it. I was like, oh shit, I got to write that down. Oh, shit.
one of them that I remember
felt that way,
sure,
and I didn't even, I'm not even you.
Was when I was, we kind of already talked about how, you know, that he just was so confident. And he, you know, again, kind of relating back to my, what had happened to me was, there was never like there was never even a crime. It was like literally someone said something offhand to a cop, you know, and I worked with cops, you know, so they like said something like kind of like a, it was kind of somebody was pissed off about something and it said something. And then the cop took it upon themselves to be like, oh, well, I'm going to investigate this crime and start going around and like questioning it. But there was like, there was never a crime. There was never a victim. Nothing ever actually, but they were going around. And all of a sudden I was like hearing from all these people that first it was that the cops are investigating you, and then it was that you did this, and then they wouldn't say that to me, but then I heard that so-and-so told so-and-so told so-and-so that you did this thing, and it was like, I'm like, what the fuck is happening? You know, there was that feeling for me where it was, and then when I finally confronted, and this was long enough ago that I wasn't, you know, where now I would never even have a conversation with a cop, you know, without a lawyer, but even then, like, I went to them, I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, this is not, and they're like, well, we think da, 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 da. I'm like, bullshit. You could never, ever, 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 ever prove that happened because it didn't happen. Why are you doing this? And I just, you know, I would, and it was kind of that same reaction. They're like, well, we think, like, no, absolutely not. And my fear was never I was going to be, and that's what I was seeing in him. And we kind of already talked about that, was it was like, my fear was, it wasn't even a fear. It was a realization that it was like, all these people think I did this bad thing that I didn't do. Like I felt like my life was ruined. It wasn't, obviously, you know, time goes on, but you know, I felt like my life was being ruined. I never even for a second thought I'm going to jail for this. You know, that didn't even cross my mind. And so kind of, that's what I was seeing in him. But the other thing was, piggybacking onto that was, to me, I kept seeing that there was no concern from what I could see where he seemed very worried that he was going to go to prison. But then when he seemed, where I saw him actually get emotional, at least it seemed to me, was with Kathy. When his wife came in and she was upset and she was crying and he's kind of, I remember what the other thing is too, but we'll talk about this first, you know, that he's consoling her. And then later in the interview, you hear him like go, you know, when they're like, well, you look at you, you're getting mad now. And he says, yeah, did you see my wife? Did you see what you're doing to my wife? Like, what did you notice the same thing? Did you get the same vibe? And what do you think about that? That the way that he was, that was the thing, because it's going to play. And I asked that because it's going to play in later as we go into the next episode too, as far as his mental state and his kind of dependence or protectiveness or whatever about his wife. So what were your thoughts on all that?
Okay. So narrow it down a little bit, because we went a little
to put it in a nutshell, yeah. He was less emotional and angry, in my opinion, about being accused of this, about being, you know, he was not concerned about being convicted of this crime. What he was upset about was two things. One was that other people were going to think he did it.
Right.
And two, the thing that he got really angry about and emotional about was that they were putting his wife through this.
Right. Okay. So first part of your question or your observation is how I would frame that is that that's what happened to you, and what's happened here, and what's happened in other situations, unfortunately, is the pool is spoiled. Like the pool of information now is tainted because somebody dropped a pebble in the wrong area or at the wrong time. You know, a great example of this is Richard Jewell. You know, talk about somebody else whose life was just ruined by those accusations.
Innocent guy, yeah.
Or even Ray Buckey in the McMartin preschool hearings, you know, just because one severely mentally ill woman made an accusation about her child at the hands of this person, and that set off a firestorm because the police took it and sent a letter to all of the community members. If your child has had any interaction with this person, they may have been molested. I mean, like, it's just crazy to think about. So yeah, poisoning the pool like that is bad police work. But in terms of how it affects the individual is significant as well, because when you are invested in your presentation And I've gone back and forth with Alan on this. Like, I remember one of the things that was impressive was how he was holding it together. I mean, part of me went, dude, why didn't you just say, fuck all y'all and get me an attorney. I'm out of here.
Yeah.
But, you know, and there are two schools of thought about that. You know, the true psychopathic or antisocial criminal feels like they can fake it, so they're going to go all in. Mm-hmm. Or the person who actually believes that they're innocent will actually go all in too, because they keep, you know, it becomes surreal to them. This cannot be happening. How is this person accusing me of this? So, you know, we can go either direction, regardless, you know, how we feel about it. Now, to your next point about how he reacted with his wife is that, and I even went to the point where I was going, is he on blood pressure medication or is he on, you know, a benzo or something that's keeping him from having like a huge surge of anger? Because there were many times throughout this, even before Holman started getting, you know, louder and angrier, it was so circular. I just thought, like, I would have thrown my hands up and said, this is bullshit. I'm out of here.
Yeah.
Or I think that I would, you know, I like to assume that I would, but, you know, we don't know until we're in those situations. But I'm sorry, Jenna, what were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to agree with you. I had the same thought, Dr. Scott, because we know, we hear about his mental health history. He talks about it and it's also out there. It's a big part of the trial. But I had the same thought because if I were going in to a situation like that, I could see myself going, I might need to take like propranolol or whatever, because just being closed in a small room with people kind of intimating that I can't leave. I mean, for a long time, I was afraid I couldn't serve on a jury because I just had this, if you've ever had a panic disorder or anxiety, it's not that you think the situation, it doesn't necessarily take a specific situation to trigger that. It could just be as simple as, what if I have a panic attack in a situation in which it's incredibly inappropriate and it's incredibly not useful? And the more pressure you feel in that situation, the more likely it is you're going to create
You're already having anticipatory anxiety response.
So it's very easy to, So it's easy to imagine being like, okay, I need to take, maybe I should take something, not something that's mind altering, but just something like propranolol.
Any of the medications that are used for blood pressure. Actually, I mean, it's sort of, in the treatment world, psychiatrists are actually starting to use as trauma treatment to prescribe blood pressure medication so that individuals can safely relive their trauma without getting all of the chemicals activated. You could process it. So to tie that back to what we're talking about is when you see him get upset because of the secondary factor, the effect that it's having on his wife and how upset she is, and it's showing how protective he feels, like, you know, either his adrenaline is pumping so much that it's pushing through or pushing through the medication, which can happen, but it's not very common. Like, I think it's notable to me. That's notable that, like, how dare you do this to this person that I care about that's here? And he's not stating. The thing that surprised me is how he did not find a voice to say, you're lying, when he knew, or if from his perspective, if we're assuming that he's innocent, he knows that there's no evidence, then why isn't he coming more forward with this? But then again, like you said earlier, Jan, everybody has their own experience with trauma and re-traumatization and how we mask and deal with it, because we are still taught that police are authority and they're there to be trusted and they're here to protect the community. And because I've worked closely with police, I've met many, many police that are absolutely invested in doing that. But I really believe that interrogation techniques like this need to be completely overhauled, because there are too many people out there. There are too many, you know, barrel-chested guys that are certified in Reid technique that have done over 11,000 interviews, you know, and they've got their LinkedIn pages going. And it's like, you're not a subject matter expert. You're a bro dude who's found your own Joe Rogan in the Reid technique.
Wow.
That's sort of my take on it. And God knows the shit I'm going to get for that.
I know, but that's so well
yeah,
said.
I would say that it is really notable that he acted with so much emotion out of care for, you know, his the main support in his life, knowing that she had been going through something similar in another room. But I don't know. But I don't know if that indicates either way about guilt or innocence.
Well, I don't think either. But what it did for me, and I think it's kind of the point you're making, is it because it seemed like he was so kind of emotionless through the accusatory part of everything and the bullet and all the stuff. But so it was almost like, does this guy, maybe he's just, for me, I'm trying to assess everything like a baseline. Like, is this just a guy that doesn't show emotion? Is that what I'm seeing here? You know, how do I judge these behaviors? But then when he had that reaction about his wife and about people thinking that he did this, then it was, for me, what it did for me was she'll say, okay, no, he does get emotional.
But it wasn't about that emotional.
That he's,
my opinion.
But it was to me is when he showed anger, but it was like he was angry at them. He pushed back on that. And so to me, it was like, okay, so he does get mad. He does get upset, but it was about these things, but not about this thing. With this thing, he was, and I think to answer your question as far as, or your, what you said about, you know, why doesn't he say you're lying? I think a lot of people don't know police are allowed to lie. And that was, to me, what I kept seeing. It just kept looking to me like confusion. Like, he's confused. Like, how can this be?
Yeah.
You're telling me without any doubt in the world that bullet came from your gun. And he's just like, I don't, like, you keep asking me to tell you how it happened. I can't. I have no idea. That's impossible. He just kept saying, it's impossible.
I think it's easy.
And he kind of hinted at.
And yet he continues with the interview, which is very... Right. It's just notable. I don't know how to interpret it because I don't have enough data. But again, and maybe it's because all of us here, we're steeped in this genre. But again, I go back to that. Why not just shut the whole thing down and say, I've got nothing else to say to you?
That part didn't surprise me a bit. I've seen, because I've just studied so many interrogations, and everybody always thinks, whether they're innocent or guilty, that they can talk their way out.
But they're going to be able to reason their way.
Yeah, so
and
that, I mean,
that makes them look guilty.
The read technique,
like
I've said before, the read technique handbook says you should expect to get your confession in the fourth hour of interrogation.
Right. So here's the thing, that this is the problem. You should expect to get your confession, but you're also going in with the assumption that the person is guilty.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
So there isn't like a neutral area of ambivalence where it's like, we're going to get some more information from this person. No, it's like they're ready to go because they feel like they have all the evidence, or they have enough evidence, or they don't have enough evidence. So now they have to go and go through this in order to wear the person down.
Yeah. Yeah. Engage in psychological warfare. And here's the steps to do it. This is how to break someone's spirit. This is how to get them to say what you want. Essentially, what the book should say is, here's a way to get people to say what you want them to say.
Mm.
It's a 4-hour process. Mm. That's what it should say, because that's what it is.
They didn't even take 4 hours.
That's what it's designed to do.
He
never confessed.
No, but I mean, by the time he gets to, like, it feels like the end of a process to me, and maybe it's not, but like, is there a point in the read technique where they're like, and if all else fails, yell at him. Like, you can go into bad cop mode and you can mirror their angry behavior, like, because that last piece where he does remain extremely calm, and it's a very uncomfortable listen after Kathy's gone and he's just, the guy's just dropping F-bombs left and right and screaming at him. It's just so uncomfortable. But
yeah, I mean, the book, it talks about getting aggressive, and he and that was the thing what I noticed too, like kind of analyzing Holman, is like, he broke character. He was going by the book, boom, 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 boom. And what you're supposed to do at that point is just keep wearing on him, right? He should have kept wearing on him for 3 more hours. But eventually, Alan did say, I'm done. Arrest me or I'm leaving. I'm done. And that's it. And that's when he put a stop to it. So he didn't get to keep going for longer. Right. I mean, he probably could have still, you know, they do sometimes still push it, because he didn't specifically say, I want a lawyer and I'm done. But he, you know, he said, I'm done. But, you know, the book talks about then, you know, scoot closer to them, get close, you know, invade their personal space
do the same thing. Scoot right into their lap and give them a big old icky on the neck.
Yeah.
Make them just as push back, make them as uncomfortable, touch their wrist, touch the inside of their wrist if you can. That always, like, is a button for freaking people out.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think this, I was going to say something else about it, but I know there's a question about it. So why don't we get into the questions you have, Janet, so we can zip through those.
Sure.
And I'm sure that'll just
For sure. And I just want to reiterate that last week, you know, I guess we'll kind of split the difference. I don't want Dr. Scott to feel beholden to answer questions about evidence or guilt or innocence rather than behavior just because we are honored to have him as a guest. So I had skipped some last week. We also just spoke for a long time because there was a lot to say. But like, for example, Whitney, I know you did post something last week. And the reason that I didn't get a chance to address it is because it was more evidence-based and more guilty or innocent or not guilty based. And we were talking more about observing behavior from the actual video. So we kind of steered away from some of that. But but I want to acknowledge, you know, you did post again. And so I'll just go ahead and acknowledge that you said, you know, can we, essentially what you asked was, can we come at this from the position that Richard Allen is actually guilty? Because everything that Whitney has seen, she believes that they caught the right person, but at the same time does not feel that the trial proved it. From what she has seen from multiple sources, she just truly believes that they caught the right person, but that it shouldn't have gone through the court the way that it did. And she feels that it leaves herself and everyone else in a super awkward position where she truly believes that the right person is behind bars, but doesn't believe they proved in court of law. So we said that a few different ways. I mean, Whitney, not to push back, I kind of do feel like we've had that conversation. I mean, I think that's something that Bob has said many times leading up to these conversations, even before these last couple of episodes. Bob, you've repeatedly said, I really don't know, and I'm really uncomfortable with the idea that this person is guilty, and yet the system failed in the sense that a guilty person still should have walked free because the trial was such a mess or because the evidence was such a mess. No disrespect. I just feel like we talked about it a little bit, at least.
Well, to address her directly, where the beginning of her question was, you know, can we approach this from the position that he's actually guilty? And the answer for me is no. That's not what it is. So it depends what you're tuning in for, right? Or if you're tuning in to somebody tell you a story or a narrative, they'll have whatever perspective they have. What we do on this show, whether you like it or trust it or not, is we analyze cases to try to determine if someone is innocent or guilty. So I'm never going to go into it. Like, I didn't go into this process with the perspective of Richard Allen's innocent, now let me watch this and prove it, or Richard Allen's guilty, let me watch this and prove it. I went into it saying, I don't know if he's innocent or guilty. Can I glean anything from these interviews that will maybe help me make a better determination because the evidence is weak? And I would, you know, I struggle with like the from everything I see, he's guilty. I'm not saying you're wrong. I don't get, and because that's one thing that there's some other people that have commented and stuff that, listen, in general, here's a little kindergarten lesson for everybody. It's okay to disagree with somebody about their conclusion and have a meaningful discussion about it. I'm constantly amazed at the people that will like, oh, I disagree, and therefore I'm angry at you because you think something different than me. And it comes out very clear in their questions or posts and stuff like that. So that's just beside the point. That's not you, post whoever this person, I forgot the name.
Whitney.
You said that. Whitney, I think. I'm not talking about you, but some other people. But for me, like when somebody says that, you know, from everything I've seen, they got the right guy. I wish that I felt that way. I really do. I do. I've been very closely kind of attached to this case for many years. It's one of those, it's literally physically close to me. It's close to where I live. When they arrested Richard Allen, I was so relieved that they finally caught the guy, and the bastard who did this is going to pay for it. And I wanted nothing more than to have all the evidence come out at trial and say they got him, and that's it. So this is not something that I'm happy about, is the fact that I don't feel comfortable. I mean, like, what, like to say everything points to him being it. I and again, this is a discussion for another episode that we will get into. But it was like, what is it that makes you like this bullet? Like, I know there's a question about it, so I'll wait to get into that. But like, that's not convincing. These interviews, I'm sure as hell not convinced by these interviews. If anything, it make me lean, as I said in the episode, make me lean the other way. The confessions, which we'll talk about next week, you know, that's the one thing that I think you could hang your hat on. But I think that this case is questionable at best. But yeah, I don't want to go on. We're already going to get to the point where we're going to run out of time if I go on too long about this. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, first of all, I don't have an out tonight like I did last week. So
me neither.
Okay. I just want to let you know. But the, you know, I get, I mean, I get this, the sentiment But I also have to point out is that we shouldn't be assuming there's guilt, because we're supposed to be honoring what is actually one of the better judicial systems in the world. And that's not saying much, you know, but we have a pretty good system here, or at least we're supposed to have a good system here. And many times we get pulled into this innocent until proven guilty, when it's actually supposed to be innocent until proven otherwise. And even in this system, we know that there are a lot of flaws and things happen. And I do, I mean, at least in the times that we've been speaking and preparing for this, is I think that we are taking a big picture. I keep saying, I don't know. I'm observing that if he is guilty, if he is guilty of these crimes, then he really deserves an award for acting, because, that interview, it was really off-putting in just hearing this person, no, that's not happening, that's not happening. But yeah, I mean, I get the sentiment, but I think that's also part of the discomfort of sitting in the gray area of not knowing. And nobody wants to be there, right? We want to be certain about things. We want to be certain about what we're looking at, what we're understanding. You're bad, this person's good. And it's just not clean like that. That's one of the reason that this whole genre keeps churning around, because, there's a never-ending conversation about it.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of the bad blood that comes out through social media or whatever about any of these podcasts or anybody that's talking about something like this, because I think there's a need from like the general population, more so that want validation. Like, people have, like, they've heard whatever they've heard, they've researched whatever they've researched, and they've come to a conclusion. And so they want to tune into the podcast and hear someone supporting the conclusion that I've come to. And I think that, and I don't think it's intentional. I think it's, in most cases, it's rooted deeper than that, but it's like, well, I've already made up my mind, and now you guys are saying something else. Well, you must not be approaching it right.
Right.
You know, it's that cognitive, and the word cognitive dissonance is thrown around like an insult all the time, but it just take it to its true meaning. It's just literally like it's hard to reconcile in your mind, I think, sometimes, if it's like, I've decided this, why is this, assuming Whitney's a fan of the show and tunes in to hear me do an analysis because she likes my analysis for whatever reason. They're like, why is this podcaster I like saying the opposite of what I believe? There has to be a reason for that. And I don't think it's something that is, like intentional or comes from a bad place or anything like that. It's just like, this isn't making sense to me. And just so you know, Whitney, or anybody that's listening to me, just because I'm saying it doesn't mean I'm right either.
Yeah.
Like I'm not any different. Somebody said something like, how can you say that he's innocent with this? And I was like, careful. I didn't say he was innocent. What I said is, after so far me hearing this much of the evidence, which we haven't had all the data available to us yet, but as we're getting it, as I've heard it, the opinion that I have personally come to is I'm feeling more and more like they've got the wrong guy. That's just my opinion. I'm not saying he's innocent. I'm saying I'm feeling that way.
Right.
And you're allowed to feel differently than that.
That's a great distinction. That's
just kind of to lay those ground rules out. And on that topic, this is so off topic, but what the hell? It's my show. I just want to point out there's a listener, her name's Jennifer. It's someone who I've had conflict with on the show and on social media in the past about other cases where we've butted heads a whole lot, and somebody that I kind of like in the time did my own version of what I'm talking about right now, where I just kind of put her aside as she's a troll. She's this. I just want to give a shout out, if she's listening or anybody is, that the kids are working on the group that's working on the Jeanette Robertson case. This person, Jennifer, has a connection to that case and has done some research on it. And despite our previous, years of hating each other online, like, reached out to me and was like, this case is important to me, I want to help. Mm. We've had a ton of communication back and forth. Mm. And I don't know. It was just one of those moments I had. It was just today. I just exchanged an email with her today. And I was thinking, like, what? Like, and neither of us are like, actually, I like you, But it's just like, I was wrong about probably what I thought her motivation was years ago, and had this opinion of her. And then now I'm seeing that, she's like, no, what it was is we disagreed about something and our personalities conflicted with each other back then.
Right. And it's so anyway, those parasocial relationships too. Like people have an assumption about, I mean, I put a lot of myself out there on our show, but you know, you're really only seeing one facet of me, or maybe you're seeing five facets, but you know,
yeah.
I have a lot. And I love that you gave that example of coming back around. We did a meetup 2 weeks ago and had, you know, like about 10 of our local LA area people come and hang out with us at Bike Shed in downtown LA, had a blast. And I had like the greatest conversation with three listeners that have very different opinions on some high profile cases than I do. And it was the greatest conversation because everybody was willing to go, well, look, this is what convinced me in this case, because I looked at this, this, and this. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like craziness. It wasn't out there kind of stuff. It was all evidence-based stuff. And I countered with, but this to me is the underpinning of it. And, the point being is like we can have healthy conversations, but we have to work at having healthy conversations. And there are a lot of people that get behind the anonymity of a keyboard and they're
you're
this because you don't agree with
me. Or you're like me and you just, you know, in this case, and we need to move on. I shouldn't have even gone on this tangent, but I don't know. All this was just reminding me of it. But it was just, you know, I had to reflect on my own, how I reacted to things. And, you know, because I got bombarded with, you know, negative shit all the time. So like I had this quick reaction. I was like, oh, I know what this person is. This person's a troll. Duh. And then now like I'm having this conversation. I'm like, well, they're not a troll. They were just mad because of what I did. And then I got mad and they said shit. And then I said shit. And then like, and it's like now all of a sudden now we're working together on something, you know, despite all that. So anyway, that's a little, that bit's for free, guys.
I don't know when the right time to bring that up would be. You know, it's not going to fall into a classic bucket of like what we're talking about in an episode. And I think I really appreciate you having that grace and knowing that she gave that grace and respect to you. I think that's really lovely to, it's never the perfect time to say that maybe, and it's never a wrong time to say that. That's important. And especially when, you know, we see that exactly what Dr. Scott was talking about, not just the like you have to have a firm decision or that everything's black and white. And Shiloh said it when she was on the show, on your show, Bob, recently, too, is this idea that we're living in an era where more than ever now it's perceived as weakness to be undecided and to feel that we live in the gray. And that's a huge bummer because that's where these kinds of confrontational, adversarial things come up where it's like, well, if you're interested in wrongful convictions, then you are categorically cannot be a victim's advocate. You cannot ever be thinking about victims' rights or a family's rights because you've the die is cast, and that's just not fair. And it's not fair for us to do the same, you know, to somebody who maybe, you know, is advocating hard for the Hay families of the world, the Heyman Lee families of the world, who, you know, at times we feel frustrated because we worry about what it's going to do to future cases. But, you know, everybody can live in the gray. It's really hard, but we can do it. And I think we can still get a lot of work done. I do want to segue into another listener, because this is another listener who's very, very thoughtful and a critical thinker and has, you know, I don't want to say push back necessarily, but has definitely isolated certain pieces that she feels were overlooked or would like you to address more succinctly in past cases as well. Kate says, where is your source? This, we'll talk about the gun here, for the statement that they tested multiple other guns that was also determined as sufficient agreement, the scientific appropriate term for a match in physical comparisons. I followed the case closely using multiple sources, both pro-defense and prosecution, and neither said they tested multiple guns, and they were also determined as meeting sufficient agreement. Only Richard Allen's did. The others were not determined to be any match. And then there's a second piece to this that is separate that we should address separately. Yeah.
Okay, so my source was a million places online. I went back to double-check this. So I had heard it, I think I originally heard it from Bob Mata. But then I went and checked several. So what I tried to do is go to just news sources from people that, like legacy media people that were at the trial and were reporting on what was said, because none of us have seen the trial transcripts yet. What they said. So The firearms expert was Melissa Oberg. And, you know, she testified everything we talked about as far as Allen 6 hour P226 that, you know, the one round was able to, they could not exclude his round because it had sufficient agreement. They also, during cross-examination, they asked if they if she compared the bullet to rounds from Brad Weber, who was the guy that lived right there, because he also had a 6 hour. And she said his gun could not be excluded either. So the language made up, but they have a sufficient enough agreement that they couldn't exclude his either. So Richard Allen's gun couldn't be excluded and Brad Weber's gun couldn't be excluded. And then they continued on through cross-examination and asked, like, could this bullet have that kind of agreement with any Sig Sauer 40 caliber that you know of this make and model? And according to every single article that I found online where they were talking about it, who were at trial that day, they said that she conceded yes, it could have, like, what I had read was, and I'm kind of reading from my notes here, that she had said, no, there's no way to pinpoint that it came from one particular gun. It very well could have come from any Sig Sauer 40 caliber from that. But it was compared to Brian Weber's, and his also could not be excluded from that. So that's my story. And I don't know what sources you have that say that was never done. But from everything, it's pretty consistent across every article I've read that, it came, you know, in direct examination, it was, yep, we did the test, it was sufficient agreement, so it probably came from his gun. And then across, it's like, wait, didn't you test it to Brad Weber's? Well, yeah, his couldn't be excluded either. Could it have come from any 6 hour? Well, yeah, it probably could have come from any 6 hour. Can it be nailed down to one gun like this? No, it can't be.
For me,
that's what I was getting at.
And all of that is important and absolutely worthy of consideration and worthy of dialogue. I don't mean to discount it for everyone across the board. I will never get past that they had to do something to the weapon that was not done on the crime scene. I'll never get past it. I mean, I just won't. I just can't. I can't have someone say, well, yes, we had to do something different. That the nature of the test radically changed. Like, I just can't. You know what I mean? I can't.
Well, that's the thing is tool mark analysis like this is bordering on, I mean, I think it is junk science. It's being challenged as junk science all over the place. But it's not, if you look at like the, if it's not, you know, scientifically, if you're doing some kind of experiment, like you have to, it has to be repeatable.
Yes.
You know, like a fingerprint.
Reliable.
Right? A fingerprint. I can put my fingerprint on any surface, anything, anywhere that I touch it, where you're able to pull a clean latent print off that's not smudged. Obviously, there could be smudge. There's a lot of different things. But if you get a clean print of my finger years apart on multiple different things, it will always match. It's a repeatable science. DNA, same thing. It either has the alleles that match or it doesn't. It's repeatable over and over again. This idea that it's like, well, it was ejected out of the gun. I ejected it out of the gun. Doesn't match. Let me try it again. Doesn't match. Try it again. Nope, that one doesn't match. This one doesn't match. Well, let's try firing it. Nope, that still doesn't match. Nope, this one's close enough. And say, yep, that's his gun.
It's like, the no, second it, you say, let's fire case, it, it's over. I'm sorry, but it is. My opinion.
I agree.
Scientifically, my opinion. It's over.
I agree.
It's just not the same.
And we can move on to our next test point. I just wanted to, sure. She asked for a source and that's the source.
Sure. And I say that, again, I also do not know if Richard Allen is guilty. I just feel that test was crazy to me. Okay. Additionally, why did you not also include observations of Richard Allen's physical reactions? Like, for instance, his constant glances at the crime scene photos of the girls, or how Kathy Allen's physical reaction, which in most opinions, she was trying to put space between her and Richard Allen. It was weird to hear your analysis not include any other observation than his words, when you could see his body language too. And in other cases where video was involved, you did comment on their physical too.
Before Scott chimes in, I'll just say from my perspective, and Scott's the expert, I just didn't see any notable behaviors. I didn't see anything that was, for example, in the first one, there was the water. There was a complete change from baseline, how he was sitting, how he was postured, what he was doing, to when there was that shift and all of a sudden his posture completely changed. He was drinking his water bottle every 5 seconds. I personally didn't see anything that I thought was a notable behavior, but go ahead, Scott, you had your hand up.
First of all, I love that you're using the word notable. Did I plant that in you?
Yes, you did.
Okay, I love it. Oh my God, I love it.
I've never heard of use it before.
It's awesome. So this is such a, I mean, I respect the question. I really respect the question. The problem is that we are wanting, in asking a question like that, is we want human behavior to be qualifiable and quantifiable, meaning every single time, every single person should react in this certain way that we expect. And our expectations are shaped by our cultural biases, our personal biases, and it may not reflect insight into our own process or understanding that that individual that we're observing has an entire life that we don't know shit about, right?
Right.
That's why, and okay, another episode we've done on this, body language interpretation is bullshit. It is like, and it's frightening to me that you can go online and Google body language experts, and there are people that are claiming all, they might as well be claiming that they're clairvoyant. And I say that as somebody who has gone to a couple of clairvoyants and like, oh, this was a great experience, right? But it's crazy how this, you know, you were talking about junk science in terms of the bullet. Behavioral analysis and body language does not have any foundation. It does not have any standardized, statistically sound basis for interpreting people. Everybody's going to act. Yes, we can glean some things that point to some people in these type of situations will most likely present this, but there's always, unless these factors are present, right? And again, it's the gray area. Nobody wants to sit in this area of not knowing. They want to be able to interpret every single one of those things. I always use the example of statistically, and this is supported, is the statistical number of men in the U.S. over the age of 40 who have lower back problems is incredibly high.
Mm.
Why is it incredibly high? Part of it is, and this is, you know, I've spoken to chiropractors and specialists, and they go, they all kind of joke. It's like, well, it's the flaw in the design, right? Luckily, we have a lot of people with low back because really our skeleton was not designed to stand up and do the things that, that we do all the time. It evolved in a different way. And the reason I go off on that tangent using that as an example is whenever I see long-term interrogation videos and you see people squirming and people like all of the armchair and detectives like jump up and go, look how uncomfortable they are. And I want to go, bitch, I have a herniated disc at L5 S1. I have to move all the time. So you're telling me that if because I'm shifting in my seat and I have to constantly cross and uncross my legs, that you're going to interpret that as something. And that could determine my guilt or innocence if I'm being interrogated.
Yeah.
It just rattles me when I hear that.
Good. That's why they were asking. And I always like I kind of land probably somewhere in between the people who are like, oh, their eyes looked up into the right, so they're lying, or their eyes looked at like that nonsense, and that there's nothing to glean from it at all. For me, I two things. One is like we talked about in the last one. It's like all I can tell is using the example of the first interview. I can note that there was a definite change in his posture and his aggressiveness. I can't tell you what that means. We're trying to get maybe, but it's like, it's notable.
Exactly. Right? And you're observing it, and we should take note of it and look at it within the context of all these other factors, right?
Yeah. And then there's some stuff I've done a ton of study on, and maybe it's all bullshit because I just read it in books. But there's some stuff that I look out for, and I tend to do it in my everyday life because after I studied it for years. And so I watch it is some like what they call like limbic system responses. And it is shockingly accurate how often people do this. But again, it's not a lie detector. Things like, you know, particularly with women, when they're uncomfortable, they tend to touch their chest and their neck.
I definitely do.
Yeah. And
but I also do it when I'm feeling strong positive feelings. Like, I'm like, oh, you, like, it's, I'm doing it all the time.
Yeah. Well, during the time when I was like studying, I was reading a tons of books on it and studying a lot of this stuff. I used to, you know, Becky and I used to sit in a bar and we just watch couples and be like, look,
okay. But Bob, that's what's really cool is you're talking about possibly one of the few areas where there is science in this area. John Gottman, the psychologist and marriage specialist, mm-hmm. and his wife, they have an institute in the Pacific Northwest where they study micro expressions. And
yes.
I mean, this guy is like a genius, and he can tell within like generally 3 to 4 minutes whether or not a couple is going to stay together because he has trained himself to pick up on micro expressions. So I take that back. This is, you know, again, or maybe I don't take it back. I'm going to say in this rarefied situation, looking at these two people with all this data set that I've collected over 30 years, I can actually predict what kind of interactions they're going to have and whether or not that's going to work. So maybe if we put some real science and did hours and hours of cameras trained on blow-ups of the iris to see if there's blood flow during certain things, you know, we could put that information in context. But until then, just be careful about what you interpret, right? Don't interpret it.
Well, and the big thing, that's it, is in the interpretation, right? So even in like some of the books I read, they would say that's an indication that they're lying. It's not an indication that they're lying. One of the books was called like The Human Lie Detector, da, 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 and it got into some of the same science and other books I read, but the other ones that were more scientifically in their approaches, yes, generally, someone, like I said, like a woman when she's uncomfortable will tend to go to the chest. A man will go to the face. Things like if they're, you know, watch people's feet. You know, if they're in a conversation and their feet are turning away, like there's something in their brain, like they're wanting to leave. It's things like that. But it would say like that doesn't mean they're lying. It doesn't mean anything bad's happening. What it just means is they're uncomfortable. Now, what does that discomfort mean? It could just mean I'm uncomfortable because I'm in a police station physical, and someone's yelling at me.
Yeah, it could be emotional or could be physical discomfort.
Yeah, there's a million different things it could mean. So that's kind of where I like, and I keep rambling. But yeah, so I get really into this. So like Becky and I, we would go to the bar and we'd look at like, you know, some guy hitting on a girl. I'm like, what do you see? I'm like, well, she seems to be into it. And I'm like, oh, nope. Oh, look at her feet. Look at her hands. Look at her eyes. Look what she's doing. Look, she's not into this. She's not in it. And then you'd watch it, you know, a few months later, she'd walk away. It was like a fun game that we would play.
Yeah. See, my version of that is like I make up dialogue for him. So I'm covering my mouth.
And oh, no. Mystery Science Theater 3000.
We would get luck back in. Sorry, Kate didn't mean to make a joke out of your thing. But yeah, the short answer to it is I just didn't see anything in any behaviors that I found to be notable enough that I could draw anything from. I don't know. Did you, Scott?
Well, if I could, I'll just say that, you know, Kate did give two examples that I think she's saying perhaps would lean towards culpability of some kind. That, you know, he's his constant glancing
at the pictures in the room. I can't.
To that, I would say, why do we stop? Why do we slow down when we see a car wreck? I mean, I just don't know. You know, I don't know. We're drawn to horrible things. That's why a lot of people are into true crime. So I don't know if there's something horrible on the desk that your eyes keep darting back to. Like, I just don't know what that means. Yes.
Right. I could also say that, like, that's an interesting point is that he's glancing or he keeps glancing. I don't know. See, all then you're inserting a descriptor in there, keeps glancing. Well, what do you mean by that? Is it 2 times? Is it 4 times? But what I do know is that, you know, working in my prior work with sexually violent predators and sex offenders is we had to be very careful about showing them any pictures that might re-stimulate them. Because you don't want to stimulate in habitual offenders, what we call euphoric recall. But that is something that has been researched about how killers on the more psychopathic end of the spectrum do want to look at it because it's their handiwork. I didn't see that here. I saw that in the framework of like, what is happening? Like, let me see if I can look at this and is there anything there that will help me, you know, maintain my composure? Again, that's just my clinical observation, which could be absolute BS. But I do know that, like, if I'm glancing at something is very different from staring and being fixated on it.
Also, there's another take that's even wider, broader than that is you're in a tiny room for over an hour. that has nothing on the walls and anything, like glancing at like how many things you're going to glance at, or you know, a million scenarios. Yeah. Is he glancing at it because he's looking at his handiwork? Is he glancing at it because that's the picture they keep pointing out to and saying that's where your bullet's at? And he's, my point, I'm not saying it's one or the other. My point is it could mean anything. It was nothing that I looked at and thought like, oh, that's telling me something. It just wasn't
right for me. Yeah. Was he looking for the bullet in the picture rather than the bodies?
And the stuff with Kathy's really hard because, again, if you respect authority, it just would be really hard to have someone isolate you and say, like, we know that it's him. So you can just stop objecting. Why don't you let it go from your mind that it's not him? What you need to start doing is learning to accept that he did this. And we're going to let you see it. You know what I mean? So I just don't know. I mean, I definitely was doing that thing where, as that was happening, I was imagining what it would be like if my partner was accused of that and people were telling me point blank. And then they were like, I'm going to put you in a room with this person, but everyone knows that you're on camera. So then it's also weird because it's like, Richard Allen knows. He knows that she's been brought in there. He doesn't. And I thought it was very interesting that he was like, don't say anything. I know, you know, I couldn't do this. That to me was actually the only kind of red flag that spoke to me, for whatever it's worth. I thought it was interesting that he, you know,
that just jumped at me. The thing I was going to circle back to that I want to hit on, Scott, and we're already over an hour now. The one thing that I saw that I thought was like an odd behavior, I didn't know what to make of, was when he kept saying, like, the way he kept telling her, like, I know, you know, I didn't do this. He was telling her, I know, like, Dr. Scott, what did you think about that?
There are two different ways to interpret it. You know, if you can go one direction where he's trying to convince her of his innocence, or he's saying it in a way that validates their relationship. Like, you know who I am. You know that I would never do this. So it's notable, but I don't know what it means. I saw him really trying to navigate a difficult situation. I'm going to completely back up on what I said earlier. She does seem really tense, and her body language is not as open to him. She's clutching onto the coat. Mm-hmm. I think she's traumatized by what she's been told. She's just been told just as many lies, if not more, than Alan has. But I think he's reading that, and he's seeing that she is acting outside her normal range of behaviors, and so he's seeking validation in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it doesn't seem like it's indicating like he's trying to coerce her, but more to like, what did they do to you? You know, he's got so many things going on right there in the you know, he's got multiple conversations going on in his head right now because he's already shown how angry he was about how the, you know, his reputation has been spoiled, and now they're interrogating her. So that's my take on it. I mean, maybe I've just muddied the waters even further, but I found that interesting myself.
Well, I mean, the answer is there's really nothing you can, it's hard to make a determination one way or the other. That's fine. It was just, to me, that was as far as notable behaviors, I'm like, well, that's interesting. I don't know. And I'm not well-versed enough to know what it could possibly mean, but it's interesting to me that he continues to say, you know, I know, you know, I didn't do this. Right. It's like, I just found it interesting, but
that really stuck out to me too. There's one thing that I want to make sure we get. Oh, sorry.
Well, Dr. Shiloh made a great comment to soothe her. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, he's working on soothing her because he sees she's so distressed. Thank you, Dr. Mm-hmm. Shiloh. Always rescuing me.
Thanks, Dr. Shiloh. Yeah. I still, that was, like I said, that was a thing that stood out to me but it was just hard for me to know. Again, because he knew he was on camera. So the idea of like them having a real conversation about this in front of the cops seems like I would probably do the same thing and just be like, I didn't do this. Like, I don't need you to be unsure of me right now in front of these people. Whether that means that she believed and continues to believe somewhere in her heart that he's responsible, I can't say. But I do want to very quickly make sure, because I don't believe that you mentioned this in the episode. And because you mentioned that we are going to be looking at the confessions, something that really stood out to me was, here we are doing the read technique. Here we are looking for the information to come from the suspect. And the cop just straight up says, Here's what I know you did with your gun. You racked it to scare them. Like, he told him what he did, which, by the way, is the thing that Richard Allen said later, but he, like, fucked it up on purpose or by mistake.
It's the thing Dr. Walla
That's what I'm saying. But that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah,
it's
yeah.
Like, that's, so that's just an example of, like, well, I kind of have to throw that away because he did not say that he did that. He didn't intimate that he had done that. He maintained that there was no way that his gun could be out there. And the police officer said, I'll tell you what you did. You held it up. You had it with you. You held it up and you racked it to scare them. So now he knows for sure they weren't shot. I mean, like, what information can you glean from that? It sounds like they weren't shot because the whole point is they weren't shot because I know that this bullet was there that was unspent because you racked it to scare them. And that's why there was not a spent bullet there. And I know when you did it and why you did it and how it ended up down there. So you're welcome.
So he's
if you want to confess at some point. Yeah. If you want to confess at some point, feel free to insert that piece of information because I've now handed it to you.
Did somebody ask a question about Holman's behavior? I feel like.
Yes. Brian said, do you think the detective losing his cool was him truly feeling like Richard was guilty for his crime or just wanting to get someone locked up for this on his watch? So I felt I didn't bring that up because I felt you kind of already answered that.
Well, I got something very particular that I want to point out about that.
Great.
So because about my third or fourth time through, I was trying to analyze Holman's behavior. Like, what do we have going on from here? I think I had seen that question come up. So I went through it again and was watching it. And I think he starts out trying to do the aggressive part and play the bad cop part. But it felt to me, and he's going to be a really good actor. Maybe he's done this a million times and he thinks he's good at it. But he seemed to me like he had lost his shit. To me, that seemed like absolute frustration. I think that he probably thought he had the right guy. But this is the part that I wanted to point out. You want some leakage? Here's some leakage. He's furious. Why is he furious that Richard Allen's not confessing? Why? Think about that. Why is he so mad? Because he knows they don't have enough evidence to convict him. They know he doesn't have enough evidence to prove it. And you know how I know that? Because the last thing that Holman says, here's your leakage, before he walks out of the room and he says, I know that you murdered those girls, and then wait for it, and I'm going to prove it. He's in an emotional state and he blurts out, I'm going to prove it.
That is really
that
interesting.
That leakage there
for the line
to me is
chosen.
He knew that they did not have the evidence to convict Richard Allen. He knew they did not have the evidence to prove that he did this. That's why he was so mad that he wasn't confessing, because he knew he had to have a confession. And as it turns out, they did need to have a confession, which they got after the whole thing in prison, which we're talking about next week. But I just found it very interesting and I kept playing it over and over again. I'm like, did he really? He did say that.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say, I know you did it. We have the proof.
Right.
He said, I know you did it and I'm going to prove it.
Yeah. Pretty chilling.
You said you found that interesting, Dr. Scott. What do you think about that?
I think you're making a really, really good point, because it's so funny because this is from way before I ever was in this genre. I'm talking like undergrad school back in the 80s. You know, one of my BAs was in English Lit, and I had, you know, like English grammar is like kind of crazy. Our language is crazy. You know, like it's not as bad as French as far as like, you know, the tenses and the adverbs and the prepositions about how we place things in time. But what you're talking about would be really interesting from a forensic linguist's point of view, because it's presupposing a possibility in the future, indicating I don't have enough, like you're saying, I don't have enough evidence, but I am going to prove it. Well, if you have all the evidence, it proves itself, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Now, I mean, we're splitting hairs, but I do think it's notable and very interesting.
Yeah. And I think that, so, and then look at the foreshadowing.
Right.
So he has all this evidence, this hard, concrete evidence. He's furious he's not getting a confession. So what is that telling me? It's telling me that he knows the thing he needs to close this case is a confession. That's what he's missing. He's not getting it. He gets mad, and then he says, I'm going to prove it. And then ultimately, what happens? They put Alan in the prison and put him in this position, and then he did prove it once he got the thing that he was looking for back during these interrogations. It's just interesting, I think.
No, it's really interesting. Just one more quick thing, and then we can call it. But Georgina asks a really good question that I do still feel unclear on, which is one of the things that what's his name uses to attack Richard Allen with vis-a-vis evidence is you put yourself there. You came for it. You put yourself there. And I'm still not clear. I understand the people that they had testify were there or seemed to have been there, all of them not being asked to identify Richard Allen in the courtroom. But putting that aside for a moment, Georgina says, do we know if he's the only man that came forward to say he was on the trail that day? And I thought that was a great question because I don't feel like I have a quantitative sense of who all came forward to say they were there. Like, who was accounted for? You know what I mean? I just don't know that.
I don't for sure know the answer to that. I feel like my memory is telling me that all the other witnesses that came forward that said that they were at the trail that day were all female. But I feel like maybe there was a couple, but I don't know. But as far as I know, he was the only man that came forward. And I think that's what she's asking.
Yeah.
The only man that came forward and said that he was there that day.
I'd love to know that answer. Yeah, I'd love to know that definitive answer to that, because it does get used all the time, as one would. I mean, that was something that, you know, Jim Clemente kept saying over and over again on his podcast. It was like, he put himself on the bridge. But that's pretty much it. I think we've, you know, Jordan, you asked for clarification about whether Abby and Libby were shot. Hopefully I answered that when I said that they weren't.
They were not. No.
And Jordan feels confused about why the bullet match evidence is the forefront of linking Richard Allen to the crime if they weren't shot. And that the answer is just, again, that there was a bullet that was found.
An unspent bullet found on the crime scene.
Still used it and tested it and stuff.
The way the current conversation frames bullet analysis is as if it is like, absolutely, it's just like a fingerprint. I mean, I remember, you know, how many times in the, you know, Dateline and 2020 have they said it's like a fingerprint of a gun? It's a fingerprint. It absolutely links. And then we find out, oh, no, that's like basically pseudoscience as well.
Yeah, it is absolutely. As a matter of fact, Holman used the term. It's just like a fingerprint in this interrogation.
You're right.
Yeah. And it is certainly not. And with that, we're going to go ahead and wrap this thing up. One other thing I want to point out. I had a couple of listeners point out that I guess not this episode, but the episode before, at the very beginning of the episode, I guess when I was just reading off of notes and not a script, I had said that it was the murder of Abby Williams. And I guess I said Kelsey German instead of Libby German. So I just wanted to correct that. I was going to this weekend try to get on and edit. It wouldn't do any good because it's already all been downloaded. So it wouldn't change it on your player. So I thought this, and then it was on Erica's computer and I couldn't get to it. But anyway, I wanted to formally correct that. And I think obviously other than the six of you know that it was not because I was disrespecting the victims. It was just because I misspoke while I was talking about it. But yeah, that was a mistake that I made two episodes ago. Just wanted to correct that. And with that being said, we're going to go ahead and we're going to wrap this thing up. I'll be back on Sunday talking about all these confessions and Dr. Walla. Dr. Scott's going to be coming back because he refuses to let Dr. Shiloh be a part of anything.
Maybe we could get her in as well.
I was going to say, why was there a reason we can't have the boat?
Maybe we'll get them both.
We had a big conversation about Dr. Walla. That was...
Yeah. Yep. So we're going to be covering all that. So Sunday will be over the confessions, and then next week's follow-up, Dr. Scott will be back, and we're going to be talking about that again. For those of you, again, that like to watch us live on YouTube, that will be at 8 p.m. Eastern Time next Wednesday, not Tuesday. And for our patrons that like the hour pregame show before that, that'll be at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Wednesday. And with that being said, Dr. Scott, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you all again next week.
Bye, folks.
Thanks, everybody.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production. Co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.